Governor Doug Ducey has outlined a plan to put more money into public schools by giving them more from the state land trust. Good idea?
He says it's not a bait and switch. I think it is a bait and switch type of a scheme.
I think there's a recognition in this plan that education, not a cost center. An investment.
I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Steve Goldstein. Also today on the show, a look at some of the pending U.S. Supreme Court cases and how they affect Arizona, the impact Latinos will have on the country's housing market.
And a play looks at the Phoenix band that took on the British invasion and won, kind of.
For 1 week, for the local record sales in the greater Phoenix metropolitan area, it outsold every artist on the charts, including the Beatles.
Plus, getting creative in downtown Phoenix, and we go to the track.
That and more on the show after a check of this hour's news.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein. Checking Friday afternoon traffic, a couple of accidents, I-17 southbound at Cactus, also I-10 westbound at 7th Avenue. That one is blocking the shoulder.
So, Steve, this morning, did you see any lightning where you were?
I saw a couple of drops, but no lightning.
Okay, ton of lightning earlier. And get this, we actually broke a record today. This is setting the bar really high in Phoenix. 1/100th of an inch of rain recorded at Sky Harbor this morning. That set the record. Apparently, we had never seen rain on June 5th before in this city. So,
well, not at Sky Harbor Airport.
That's true. At Sky Harbor Airport, right? So we have all been part of history today. We should all be very very proud of that. Partly cloudy skies for the rest of the afternoon with a high of 95. Slight chance of rain continuing into tonight. Overnight lows in the low to mid 70s. Chance of rain tapering off tomorrow with a high of 97. It's 87 degrees at 2:05.
Faced with the reality that Arizona spends the least amount of state money on K-12 education, Governor Doug Ducey outlined a proposal on Thursday that would increase the amount of money the system gets from the state land trust. Ducey says it would bring $1.8 billion to schools over the next 5 years. But what exactly is the state land trust? I asked Vanessa Hickman, former state land commissioner and currently director of the Large Landowner Initiative at ASU's W.P. Carey School.
As the western states started coming into territory status and into statehood, Congress set up a mechanism by which the states could be allocated land grants to generate revenue for a public education system. When Arizona became a territory, they were granted two sections in each township, and upon statehood, an additional two sections and additional lands to reach a sum of about 10.9 million acres of land, which could be used to generate revenue for universities, K-12 public education, and other beneficiaries. So today we have 9.2 million acres remaining of the original land grants, and those lands generate revenue by the activities on those lands, whether they are grazing leases, mineral leases, commercial development, and the land department will also sell land for various types of uses, whether it's residential or commercial, if the land has achieved its highest and best use.
And Vanessa, how is that money distributed?
If it's a permanent disposition, if it's an asset that leaves the trust, the revenue goes into the permanent fund. If it is a lease or another activity, which is more temporal in nature, those revenues are distributed directly to the beneficiaries. So it results in a situation where you have a permanent fund, the corpus of the trust, from the permanent activities, and that is administered by the state treasurer. And then you have those expendable revenues from the other activities, which are distributed directly to the beneficiaries each year.
Vanessa, how is it determined? Do we look at sort of how things are going in the economy, how people are valuing land, as to whether the land is used for leasing or whether it's determined that land should be sold?
The land department does quite a bit of proactive planning, both internally and with the cooperation of private partners. It analyzes the market and makes determinations of where the market is peaking and doing very well, and generates multiple conversations with private parties and public parties who have interest in acquiring state trust land. They'll look at comparables from the area. They'll look at where the greatest interest is in specific regions of the state and make decisions to move forward with a piece of land if it's market ready, if it has infrastructure, roads, utilities, if it has zoning, or if there's another proposal which could generate revenue for the trust that is a unique type of use for a specific piece of property.
Vanessa Hickman is director of the Large Landowner Initiative at the W.P. Carey School of Business at ASU. She's also Arizona's former state land commissioner. Vanessa, thank you.
Thank you very much, Steve. I appreciate it.
Ducey's plan has drawn both support and criticism, and we'll hear both perspectives now, starting with Todd Sanders, president and CEO of the Greater Phoenix Chamber of Commerce.
I was impressed. I think Governor Ducey showed a tremendous amount of leadership and vision in not only putting together the plan, but on the plan itself.
Do you think that your colleagues in the business community are as supportive as you are? And I ask because there's been some talk of a possible ballot measure to increase taxes to get more money into education.
Yeah, and there have been discussions about that. I think that after yesterday, I think people are going to have to really reconsider that. The plan that was outlined yesterday, is obviously a 10-year plan. It's got 5 years of funding at 10%, and then it ramps down for a soft landing. So I think that really shows a strong commitment to the K-12 system. And I, from what I'm hearing from colleagues and members, is that this is really going to be a shot in the arm.
What about this plan has you particularly excited about the prospect of the education system getting some more money?
Well, I think there's a recognition in this plan that education is not a cost center. It's an investment. And as we at the Greater Phoenix Chamber through our Phoenix Forward Initiative talk to businesses and ask them, what's it going to take for you to grow? The number one thing they tell us is a qualified workforce. And this is absolutely what is needed to ensure that we have that qualified workforce. So that, to me, is one of the key things. Additionally, we're not talking about a token amount of money. These are real dollars that are going to make a difference in the classrooms.
What details are you most interested in or anticipating to say, yes, I'm 100% behind this, or that might need some tweaking?
Well, I mean, I think we're going to want to understand the way that the dollars are going to be allocated, and whether or not other parts of the K-12 system are going to have an opportunity. For instance, the CTE side, the career and technical education side, is such an important part of the system. We want to make sure that there is an emphasis on the whole K-12 system.
State trust land issues seem to be on the ballot fairly regularly, and they're often seen as just very complex and confusing, and the conventional wisdom, as you know, is that when voters don't really understand what a measure does, they just vote no. So how do you plan to go about trying to convince voters that this is one that they should support?
Well, you're absolutely right. You're right. We do have a track record with trust land. Trust land is difficult, and it is because it's very complicated. But I think as we look at Prop 118, which the governor talked about yesterday, I think it was the messaging was simple and it was to the point. And I think the same thing has to happen with regard to this proposed initiative. We're going to have to talk about what the goal is and how we're going to get there. And I think if we can do that and keep it simple, voters are going to understand that this is the right direction for Arizona.
Todd Sanders is president and CEO of the Greater Phoenix Chamber of Commerce. Todd, thanks.
Thank you, Mark.
People who are less enthusiastic about the governor's proposal are taking more of a wait-and-see approach. One notable exception to that is Ann Eve Peterson, president of the Arizona Education Network.
What he's proposing to do, I'm concerned, threatens that resource, which was set up to function in perpetuity for Arizona school children. If you do something right now for a short-term gain, what you're doing is really harming future generations. Mm. If you bring down the corpus, if you don't reinvest funds back into the corpus of the fund, it would be like, you know, someone who wants to retire dipping into their retirement funds, and at the end of the day, down the line, there is just not going to be the money there that there should be. When you look at his public statements about this, you know, he considers this just to be $5 billion just sitting there, up for grabs, evidently, and it's not up for grabs. He says it's not a bait and switch. I think it is a bait and switch type of a scheme. And I think that the other piece that's concerning is that I seriously doubt when this ballot measure, the language comes out of the legislature, that it will have firm enough language in there that doesn't give the legislature some wiggle room to basically use these funds to supplant existing education funds rather than supplement them.
What do you make of his aversion to raising taxes? And do you think that ultimately hurts the state as it relates to education funding? If he comes up with this idea, which some people are enthusiastic about, but is that the only idea that can be considered because he does not want to raise taxes?
Yes. I mean, I think he has to, for PR purposes, look like he's addressing this problem. But really, without some sort of revenue, and you could also eliminate some of the tax breaks that have gone out in recent years. So you don't have to raise taxes. You could just eliminate some of the tax breaks, especially some of the corporate tax breaks that have been doled out.
If this were to go on the ballot, if it were to pass, wouldn't even go into effect until 2017. And in
right.
the meantime, we have 18 months until then. And then if, as you say, it's not an effective use of the funds anyway, because it won't really generate enough, it's dipping into this nest egg, what will it take there for there to be momentum to not just oppose that, but to come up with a plan that has the force behind it to get the business community, get average folks into a contrary plan?
I think it would be very possible to craft something. Voters are very willing to tax themselves to pay for education. They've proven that in Arizona's history. The problem arises, the measures that have failed are ones in which you have had a governor in opposition to them. And so, unfortunately, right now we have a governor who I think is very anti-public education and anti-revenue generating. He does not want to generate through taxation or by rolling back some of the corporate tax breaks enough funds for our schools.
Ann Eve Peterson is president of the Arizona Education Network. Now that we're in June, the U.S. Supreme Court is counting down to the end of its term, when justices' decisions on some of the most contentious cases will be released. Several of those will affect Arizona, including redistricting, lethal injection, and same-sex marriage. So we called ASU law professor and former U.S. Deputy Solicitor General Paul Bender for insights. We started with Arizona State Legislature versus Arizona Independent Redistricting Commission.
It's important to understand that it affects only the districting of congressional seats. It doesn't affect the districting of the state legislature, because the argument that the state legislature is making is based on the U.S. Constitution, and the provision in the U.S. Constitution only talks about congressional seats. And the provision they're relying on is one that says the times, places, and manner of holding elections for senators and representatives shall be prescribed in each state by the legislature thereof. And they're saying, hey, that says the legislature, we're the legislature, therefore it was unconstitutional for the people of Arizona to give that job to the redistricting commission. So if they were to win that, then the districts that the redistricting commission have drawn would be subject to being changed, substituted by the legislatures drawing its own districts. And I would assume that they would probably call a special session and try to do that so they make sure they get it done in time for the 2016 election.
The court also heard an Oklahoma case related to death penalty, lethal injection, and how the cocktail is given out. Arizona has had, obviously, its own complications with that. What were the arguments made in this case, Paul?
Although the case is from Oklahoma, it could just as well be from Arizona. And in fact, the case was argued for the inmates by an Arizona lawyer because Arizona uses the same drug that Oklahoma was using. The issue there is the drug that all the states that had lethal injection were using, which nobody seemed to have any problems with, has become unavailable. The drug we're talking about is the first drug that they give, which is supposed to put the inmate into an unconscious position where he can't feel any pain, because the other two drugs are enormously painful in stopping the heart and stopping respiration unless you're unconscious. And the drug that had been used to do the unconsciousness has become unavailable, I think because the drug companies that make it refuse to sell it to states that want to use it to kill people. And so the states have had to scramble around and look for another drug. And Oklahoma and several other states, including Arizona, have settled on this drug, which has had a very bad history. There have been a couple of executions that just didn't go well at all. And the argument is, hey, there's a good chance that you are subjecting these people to cruel and unusual punishment. You don't know whether they're suffering. Justice Kagan at the argument said it was like being burned at the stake if you weren't unconscious, the burning feeling you would get.
Paul, how impactful could this decision be? I suppose it doesn't, one way or the other, starting a movement toward eliminating capital punishment or just eliminating this particular way capital punishment is doled out.
Well, you can't tell. You know, Nebraska just got rid of capital punishment over the veto of the Nebraska governor. Whether this problem had anything to do with that, I don't know, but it might. The harder it is, the more expensive it is, more difficult it is to do capital punishment. If the inmates win, then the states are going to have to say, how are we going to execute people? Go back to firing squad? Mm-hmm. Go back to hanging?
Paul, one final topic is that of same-sex marriage, which it seems like, at least in the public, has momentum and support there. What were the arguments made there, and what states would be affected by this one?
Arizona would be affected because we have a constitutional provision that bans same-sex marriage, and it's the same provision that's at issue in these cases. There are actually four cases. So if the court holds that there's a constitutional right to same-sex marriage, then the Arizona provision becomes unconstitutional under the U.S. Constitution, and we would have same-sex marriage permanently in Arizona. We have same-sex marriage now because the Ninth Circuit held that the Arizona provision was unconstitutional, and the Supreme Court refused to stay that or take that case. So we now have same-sex marriage, but if the challengers, if the people who want same-sex marriage lose the case in the Supreme Court, that'll go away, and same-sex marriage will then become illegal in Arizona again. On the other hand, if they win, then permanently there won't be same-sex marriage in Arizona.
There's an obsession of sorts among court observers about how many 5-4s we'll see. Of the three issues we discussed, do you expect those to be razor thin?
They all could be 5-4. My guess is that gay marriage will be. The death penalty, I would say, probably will not be, and maybe it would be 6-3 or 7-2. And the IRC case, again, I think might be 6-3 or 7-2.
Paul Bender, professor of law at the O'Connor College of Law at ASU. He's also a former deputy solicitor general of the U.S. Paul, thank you for the time.
You're welcome.
Coming up, when you look at yourself in the mirror, do you wish you saw something different?
What we're likely to be told by the world, by society, is that maybe we're a good person, we're a really good friend, we're funny, we're loyal, we're smart. But what we're never told is that our bodies are okay just the way they are.
Details on the Body Love Conference. It's the show.
Good afternoon. As you just heard, it is the show on KJZZ with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein. We're expecting these clouds to stick around for at least the end of the day. And then from there, we'll have partly cloudy skies tonight with lows in the mid to upper 70s. Should be mostly sunny tomorrow with a high in the upper 90s. Currently, we have cloudy skies and 81 degrees at KJZZ. Meanwhile, in Valley traffic, accidents on the 101 westbound at 7th Avenue. Be careful of that one. It's blocking the right lane. And there's also a collision that blocks the shoulder, I-10 westbound at 7th Avenue. It's 222.
KJZZ is supported by Bonhams International Auctioneers and Appraisers. Bonhams specialists will visit Arizona mid-June to provide confidential auction estimates of fine jewelry, paintings, prints, and photographs. Details at bonhams.com/Arizona.
A new report looks at the impact Hispanics will have on the country's housing market over the next several years. It's published by the Demand Institute, which is a division of the Conference Board. Louise Keeley is the Demand Institute's president.
We wrote this report because there is tremendous need and discussion around Hispanics and the role that they are going to play in housing and homeownership over the next decade. They're a rapidly growing population. They're going to be very important as a contributor to household formation, and so we wanted to better understand what they're looking for from homes and communities and how their demand is going to evolve over the next several years.
And what did you find?
We found that Hispanics are an incredibly important driver of household formation over the next several years. We think of them as the new baby boomers and a group that businesses and policymakers ignore at their peril. They're going to contribute to over a third of household formation between now and 2020.
Why was it so important, do you think, to look at this particular population of potential homeowners as opposed to general homeownership among the American population?
Hispanics are an important group from a size perspective, but also they present a little bit of a paradox, if you will, because on the one hand, we do see that the ownership rate for Hispanics has gone down over time, and they were hit disproportionately hard by the housing crisis. But at the same time, the demographics for Hispanics really favor homeownership to be on the rise for them going forward, and they are such an important contributor to the housing market. And actually, they've been a contributor, a net contributor to the number of owned households in the past couple of years, in contrast to non-Hispanic households.
Did you find any differences generationally as far as where folks wanted to live or were moving to or what they were looking for in a house?
So Hispanics in general tend to be a younger cohort. They're much more likely to have children. And so a lot of their homeownership preferences or housing preferences generally are reflective of that life stage. So they are looking for single-family homes, for larger space, disproportionately because of their age and their life stage.
Does that sort of skew the results based on available housing or what other folks might be looking for as far as what the demand and what the supply might be?
So one of the very interesting findings for us was what we think of or what we call a gap in homeownership aspirations. So we estimate that there's about 2.5 million Hispanic households that are seeking to own a home, which is very much consistent with the life stage of having children and raising a family and their ability to afford that. But rather than seeing that as a negative, we actually think that identifying that is an important opportunity. We see it as an opportunity for businesses and for policy to better understand what is it Hispanics are looking for, what are their needs, and finding ways to address it.
How do you expect or maybe hope that the data that you collected will be used?
My hope is that business leaders and policy leaders look at this data and A, see Hispanics are an important, tremendous opportunity, that they have real needs that are not being met by the current housing stock and current environment, but that there is an opportunity to meet their needs and to help them to reach their aspirations and reach their goals in terms of their housing, in terms of their finances, in terms of the types of communities that they live in.
Louise Keeley is president of the Demand Institute, which published the report called Hispanics and Homeownership. Louise, thank you.
Thank you, Mark.
The concept of body love sounds simple, but for many is actually very complex. The basic idea is to love your own body even with all its flaws and to feel comfortable in your own skin. But because there are constant images and ideas about what bodies should look like, many people don't feel their body fits the ideal, which can make it tough to feel like your body is good enough. Jess Baker is a body-positive blogger and founder of this weekend's Body Love Conference in Tucson, which aims to address those issues.
When people ask me why I focus so much on body image and body activism, what I tell them is that it seems kind of vapid and superficial, but it's really not, because what we're likely to be told by the world, by society, is that maybe, you know, if they're going to compliment us, we're a good person, we're a really good friend, we're funny, we're loyal, we're smart, maybe we're extraordinary in some ways. But what we're never told is that our bodies are okay just the way they are. And the reality is that the way we feel about our bodies determines the way we participate in the rest of the world. So the way we feel about, you know, everything that we are and everything that we do is directly related to our outer shell as well. So yeah, I love to talk about personality and all the great things that people are and do. But the body is just as important and something that as a society we shame and hate. So there's really a need for discussion around that and some healing around that.
Jess, at one point in your life, did you feel like you were facing these body image challenges yourself? And did you look around and say, I'm not really getting a lot of help or support with this, or at least people who look like me, I'm just not seeing them in public life?
Well, I never really realize that there was another way of living. I didn't know that you could love your body, actually, until a couple years ago. And to be honest, 26 is pretty early to realize that for compared to a lot of people. So I didn't know. And the realization came reading a blog where it had this woman who loved all the things I did. It was called The Nearsighted Owl, you know, and she had a purple beehive and cats and thrifted. And she was also really, really fat. And I use that word because it's not negative, just what we've constructed around it is. And it kind of broke my brain. And I was like, this girl, Rochelle, is living a happy life and she's fat. Maybe I don't have to hate myself for the rest of my life. Oh my God. And it's one of those things where once you kind of realize that, you can't unknow it. And to be honest, you know, there's more good days than bad, but you still feel the effects of society. And you always will, I think, because we have been, quote unquote, brainwashed, you know, for me over 2 decades. And it takes a lot to get over that.
What can the response be? I mean, it seems to me that people who would bully others who don't look the way they think have other problems of their own. When you talk about body love, is it okay to just be the one that loves your body, or do we have to have other people love the body as well?
No, we don't need outside affirmation, ideally, but we do not live in utopia yet. So a lot of times people do require maybe their loved ones or people that are close to them to help them through this healing process of body acceptance by sharing that they are enough, they are worthy on all of those things. And you also ask kind of, you know, how do you address people who have issues with your body and do they have issues of their own? And the answer is absolutely. And there's this really fascinating concept that I love to talk about called body currency. We are told that if we achieve this perfect body that is presented in our media, then we will achieve success, love, worthiness, and happiness, ultimately. And we will not achieve that before. We have this wonderful, perfect body that we are all striving for. What's happening with this movement of body acceptance is that it's challenging that status quo. It's challenging that pot of gold at the very end.
Jess, I had one other question for you specifically about the Body Love Conference. I was looking at the topics that are included, and one is teaching children body positivity. Is it possible if someone is too young that you perhaps start them down a road that they wouldn't have thought of themselves?
It's not necessarily, you know, saying, oh, you're so beautiful, you're so pretty, not placing all the focus on that, although, you know, children can feel good about the way they look as well, but really like emphasizing what wonderful humans they are, making sure you include all of those things, and also teaching acceptance of other bodies. Children are surrounded by the same media we are. They know about body image issues long before we realize. And of course, their parents are their biggest teachers. So it's not something that we're going to I don't think it's something we're going to trigger in them too early. But I think the way we address it's really important. And so parents learning how to love themselves and just letting that ripple out to their children, which I really love.
That's Jess Baker. We've been talking about the Body Love Conference taking place on Saturday in Tucson. Jess, thank you for the time today.
Thank you so much.
The summer heat doesn't stop dedicated runners and walkers from keeping up their exercise regimens, but it's more likely that they'll be out before the sun comes up or after it's gone down. That's when awareness of the world around you becomes even more important. Ann Wallach, longtime Valley runner and owner of Runner's Den in Phoenix, says there are wise things to practice for safe summer running and walking.
Well, we always recommend that it's good to run with other people. The buddy system is a great thing to have in mind when you're out running, and I've run in the Valley for 30 plus years, almost every day, and I have never had a problem here. By the same token, I don't want to minimize any potential dangers that might be out there. So if you are concerned about scary people or suspicious looking people out on your run, I think the first thing to do is to use common sense. And as we said, it's always great to run with someone. Mm-hmm. Barring that, a great big dog that can run with you is also a good idea. If you're running on your own, it's really smart to let someone know what your course is going to be and what time you plan on being back.
What about those who tend to get motivated by music? So, of course, they've got their iPod on or whatever it may be. What about folks like that who may be running by themselves and they sort of get into the music?
I know people love to wear their earbuds and listen to music as they're running. I hope that they keep it at a level low enough that they are aware of what's going on around them, that they can hear people coming up behind them. I know for a fact that a lot of people keep their music on so loud that they are startled when I run past them on the canal. And that is a pet peeve of mine because I think it's just dangerous in general that you can't hear dogs, you can't hear traffic, you can't hear people coming up behind you. It's just not a good idea. So if you are going to wear earphones or earbuds and have music with you, make sure it's low enough that you can hear things around you. And maybe you even take one out. Keep one in and keep one out while you're running, just to be safe.
Also, this weekend looks like that jump into the summer where we're going to see 103, 105 degrees, which means, of course, logically, we're going to get more people running at night. They're going to run earlier in the morning. In order to really get your exercise in, you might be out there at odd times when it's really
dark.
That's
true. So. And I run early in the mornings, and sometimes it's 5 or 5:30. You should always be running against traffic. I mean, let's be honest, cars and traffic are also dangers to runners. Wear reflective clothing. If you want to make sure you're seen, you can always buy one of those little flashy lights to wear on your clothing. It's very important that you are aware of where you're going and assume that they don't see you. I think that's always the best thing.
Ann Wallach, who's been running and jogging around the valley for three decades and is the owner of Runner's Den.
Still to come, the Arizona Science Center wants people to get together to work on projects both high and low tech.
The focus is on really getting your hands dirty, not being afraid to make mistakes, and learning new things by experiencing new things.
That's ahead. It's the show.
Do expect these clouds to stick around with us at least until nightfall. And then for tonight, lingering chance of rain should taper off by the middle of the night. And look for overnight lows in the mid to upper 70s. For tomorrow, we'll start off partly cloudy and then becoming mostly sunny by the afternoon. And we'll stay a little bit below normal. Look for a high of 98. Currently under cloudy skies, it's 81 degrees at KJZZ. To the Valley Freeways, accidents on the 101 westbound at 7th Avenue. That's blocking the shoulder. Also I-10 westbound at 7th Avenue. It's the show at 2:35.
KJZZ is supported by AJ's Fine Foods, announcing their seafood extravaganza with a selection of fresh seafood and shellfish flown in daily. 10 Valley locations can be found at ajsfinefoods.com.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Nancy Lyons. China says allegations it may have been involved in hacking U.S. government computers are irresponsible and unscientific. Yesterday, it was disclosed the personal information of up to 4 million current and former federal employees may have been compromised. White House Press Secretary Josh Earnest says FBI officials are looking into how it happened.
They are working actively to understand exactly the scope of this particular intrusion, but also to determine who is responsible.
The breach is among the most far-reaching theft of information on the federal workforce. A 26-year-old Boston man shot to death by police Tuesday has been laid to rest. Usama Rahim had been under surveillance by the FBI for alleged terror-related activities. Police say he threatened them with a knife when they tried to question him. From member station WBUR, Fred Tice reports, while the video of the shooting has not been made public, some have seen it.
It's largely limited to law enforcement officials, clerics, leaders of the African American community. And Thursday evening, the family got to see the video. And the next step would be to release the video to the public out of sensitivity for the family. They did not want to release the video until Osama Rahim had been buried.
Police officials have said the video shows officers ordering Rahim to drop the weapon and initially retreating before going on to open fire. Consumers are borrowing more. The Federal Reserve reports in April borrowing surged largely due to a big gain in credit card use. Overall borrowing expanded by $20.5 billion, pushing consumer credit to a record of nearly $3.4 trillion. On Wall Street today, the Dow lost 56 points, the Nasdaq gained 9, the S&P fell 3. This is NPR News.
The Arizona Science Center is working to turn part of the old Phoenix Museum of History right next door into a new state-of-the-art makerspace. When it's finished this fall, the 6,500-square-foot space called Create will allow visitors to work with all sorts of tools and equipment, as well as other like-minded people on lots of different kinds of projects. To get a sense of what the new space is all about, I met Stephen Weiner there. He's program director for Create at Arizona Science Center. We spoke in a big open room while construction workers continued getting the space ready.
This is where we suspect a lot of the collaborative, the community-based activities are going to be. Very flexible, but hopefully very active. I mean, you can see there's a big orange stripe running down the middle and up the wall, lots of colors. And in a few weeks, there's going to be lots of work tables in here. You can see the storage is already up. And on the ceiling, there are these architectural features which delineate space.
So are we talking like DIY kind of things? Are we talking like science fair kind of things? What's going on?
Yes, all of those things. Although DIY is sort of, I would say that'd be like the 1.0 version of this kind of idea, because we're not just telling people to do it themselves, to do it yourself, but it's really to do it together, to make things as a community and learn from each other as a process.
So what's the benefit to the city of having a space like this?
The benefit is, there's a lot of benefits, actually. So in addition to giving the public access to a whole bunch of tools that some people may never have even heard of, certainly not have had experience with, like computer-controlled woodworking tools, 3D printers, I've said laser cutters, sewing machines, all these sorts of things, which some people may just not have that in their garage. The other aspect here is to create that community, to create a center of gravity for people who like these things, to connect with others, and give Phoenix that kind of a sense of place, that there is a creative, innovative, inventive community here. And hopefully that will start a momentum, give some momentum to people who want to, you know, make their own things, better the community, and better Phoenix.
Is this, in your mind, a way to sort of, in some ways at least, centralize some of those creative activities that are already, I'm sure, happening in different parts of the valley?
Yeah, absolutely. We know this stuff is happening. We know there are places like this that are starting to pop up, not only in Phoenix, but all over the country. There is a resurgence in this desire to get your hands dirty and learn by doing, learn by making things. So we really just want to tap into that.
A lot of the equipment that you mentioned, 3D printers, some of the computer-assisted stuff, that stuff can't be cheap. Where are you getting the money to buy all this equipment?
Yeah, so we've had a lot of very generous donations to this point, and we expect that, you know, hopefully that kind of thing will continue. This is not a for-free place, so there are going to be parts that people have to pay for. But at this point, yeah, it's lots of very generous donations.
What are you most excited about for this space?
Oh my gosh, I'm excited about so many things. I'm mostly excited to see all of the things that I can't think of that children are going to do, adults are going to do in here, what people are going to make in here with the tools that we're providing them, with the inspirational sort of starting activities. We know that they're going to look at those and they go, that's amazing, but what if we did this, right? What if we used the laser cutter to do this? Or what if we wanted to make clothing that was also reactive with LEDs to a sensor, or, you know, utilized a computer that was sewn in, right? So the way people are going to combine the technology and combine the different materials and tools we have, I'm excited to see what people are going to come up with.
What do you envision the relationship between this facility and the main science center over there?
Yeah, so the way we're looking at it is, if the science center is where people become primarily inspired, this is where they go to act. We think, obviously, you'll be inspired here, but the focus is on really getting your hands dirty, not being afraid to make mistakes, and learning new things by experiencing new things.
Stephen Weiner is program director for CREATE at Arizona Science Center. The renovation will cost more than $1 million. The space is expected to open this fall.
After the First World War, entertainment venues began sprouting up in cities across the country, several right here in the Valley. One in particular is still in Mesa after 90 years, but you have to really look around to find it. KJZZ's Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez takes us there.
on Main Street in downtown Mesa is an entertainment venue called the Nile Theater. This live music spot has been here since the 1920s. Did you know the Nile Theater was among the first artificially cooled buildings in Mesa?
This was a very expensive, innovative building in its time.
Vic Linoff is president of the Mesa Historic Preservation Foundation. He says the estimated $150,000 it took to construct a building had a large box far back under the theater stage filled with huge blocks of ice. A fan behind it helped blow cool air through ventilation tunnels that led to small grills on the floor.
Yeah, this was very early and this was very novel. Picture a big truck coming in, dumping 4, 5, 6 tons of ice into this chamber.
The original entrance of the Nile Theater faced Main Street. Today, the space has been split into two areas, a small coffee shop in the front and the theater behind it. To enter the theater, you have to walk around back to the alley. It is now an open square space with most parts of the room draped in black. Large ceiling fans help keep it cool. The Nile Theater opened in 1924 when silent films were popular. This was a 600-seat theater with an orchestra pit and large stage. It was big enough to also host plays and other types of performances.
When it opened, the grandest Wurlitzer organ in the valley at the time was installed in this theater.
Linoff says after World War II, like many other cities, Mesa began growing and new theaters were built further away from its central area. The Nile Theater couldn't attract crowds, and it closed in 1953.
When the theater failed or closed, all that was required was enclosing this space into a box. You wouldn't have known there ever was a theater here.
The building has gone through many changes since it closed. The plaster ceiling and walls have been removed. Modern flooring now levels the sloped floor that made it a theater. And where the stage once stood is now the entrance of the venue. And the stage is on the opposite side. But there are remnants of what was once here. The fly house, where the stage curtains and sceneries are pulled and stored, is still there, untouched.
So now you're down in an area where there would have been dressing rooms and...
And in the basement, tucked between the theater floor and the basement ceiling, is a concrete box. It's believed to be a cooling ventilation tunnel. It's been filled with bricks for safety. During our visit, Linoff found that much of the 1920s building frame is intact. It's the show. I'm Nadine Arroyo Rodriguez.
If you have ideas or know things that we should know, please tell us about them. The show at KJZZ.org.
Good afternoon. You're listening to the show on KJZZ. We're bringing you more of our community mixed with national stories and international news Thursdays and Friday afternoons at 2. How about this for a record? The National Weather Service says the 0.01 inch of rain recorded at Sky Harbor by 7 this morning was the largest amount for this date. There has not been any precipitation recorded previously on June 5th in Phoenix.
Setting the bar real high on that.
Yeah, it's still cloudy. It's kind of amazing. Might actually get a few more sprinkles today. 40% chance for some more rain tonight with lows in the lower to mid-70s. And then for tomorrow, very slight chance of rain in the morning, becoming mostly sunny with a high of 98. In Valley traffic, one troublesome accident remains, 101 westbound at 7th Avenue.
KJZZ is supported by Staples, now offering business loans to provide access to capital for small business entrepreneurs with one application and a personal advisor. More at staples.com/loans. Staples, make more happen.
And Bob Baffert get yet another chance at a triple crown.
That was from the Preakness Stakes last month. American Pharoah goes for the Triple Crown tomorrow at the Belmont Stakes in New York, but will not be the only horse there with Arizona connections. Trainers Bob Baffert with American Pharoah and Todd Pletcher, the trainer for two horses in the Belmont, are both products of the Racetrack Industry Program at the University of Arizona. It's the only one of its kind in the country. Director Doug Reed calls it the education alarm for the horse racing industry. I caught up with him in New York, where he's getting ready for the Belmont, and asked him how a program like this ended up in Tucson rather than a horse racing hotbed like Kentucky.
Understandable question, and I get that one a lot, and it's a kind of a great story, and I'll make it short though, but basically there were several people in a bar and thinking we needed more educated people in the industry, and they decided to pursue that interest by getting a college degree program. So they started shopping that idea to different universities. They went to a number of universities, and actually the University of Arizona was the only one that said, we'll give it a try, give us a little startup fund, and we will try it. And they tried it here in Arizona, and it's turned out to be a very successful program. So it's kind of, that's how come it's where it is.
How much of the horse racing industry would you say has some kind of connection to this program?
Oh, boy, I don't know, but everywhere I go and every entity almost has our alum everywhere now because we've been around for so long. So it's kind of pleasant. I went to the Belmont Draw where they drew post positions and ran into five alumni that were working for the New York Racing Association, among a number of others. I ran into one yesterday that they're kind of in every aspect of the industry, which is really neat.
So you're in New York for the Belmont Stakes tomorrow, and there are two trainers who went through this program, including Bob Baffert, whose horse American Pharoah is vying for the Triple Crown. You must be like a proud parent of this thing.
Well, it's exciting. Now, neither of them were, they've been out of the program since I've been director, so I didn't directly get to be their instructor, if you will, but it is certainly exciting. Bob was in the very infancy. He's a local. His family's from Nogales, Arizona, so he went to the kind of the local state university, and he was one of probably the very first few students. The program was very much in its infancy and really only a couple courses. Todd came along in the 80s, I believe, and, the program has just kind of evolved slowly but surely over the years, and so he was a little more recent, but it is very exciting to have both of them. Kind of hard from a rooting interest having both alums there, but it has been exciting. In fact, it's kind of exciting being here. I'm at a conference today, and then tomorrow we get to go to the Belmont, and this is the stage for racing this weekend, and it's nice to have so many alums involved, not just those two trainers, but a number of them working at the track and here to see the Belmont.
Do you have any money on either of the horses with U of A connections?
Well, not yet, but I've got to do my handicapping. I do have to actually make a $2 wager on American Pharoah for my brother. He wants the souvenir ticket in case racing has a Triple Crown winner.
Doug Reed is the director of the Racetrack Industry Program at the U of A. We reached him in New York, where he'll be attending the Belmont Stakes tomorrow. Doug, thank you so much.
Well, thank you for having me, and have a great day, and good luck to all the horses in the Belmont.
It's the show. He's Mark, I'm Steve, and here's the takeaways, John Hockenberry.
Where does something genius like this song released 50 years ago this week come from? This is not a Mozart story of scribbling down genius on manuscript paper. It's more like Keith Richards falling asleep on a bender while jamming with the tape recorder running. Music historian John Kovac told The Atlantic that when Richard listened to a fully recorded tape long after his hangover, all he heard was a lot of snoring. He actually didn't remember recording anything, but for a few seconds, there it was on tape, the basic melody and riff to this, one of the greatest rock songs of all time. John Schaefer, host of Soundcheck and New Sounds at our partner station WNYC. Welcome, John.
Hi, John.
I gather the creative technique of being nearly comatose is not confined to the Rolling Stones.
No, although the amazing thing about the Keith Richards story is that somehow the next morning it still sounded as good as it did the previous night. That rarely happens.
That's magic. That's magic. All right, so there are some other examples here.
Well, you know, one of the most famous examples, not so many years after the Rolling Stones, is Iron Butterfly and their one and only hit, the 17-minute-long behemoth that we know as In a Gata Da Vida.
In a Gata Da Vida, honey, don't you know that I'm loving you? In a Gata Da Vida, baby, don't you know that I've always been true?
Now we don't have to listen to the whole 17 minutes.
No, we don't. And In a Gata Da Vida occurs at the beginning and the end. In the middle, it's mostly instrumental. A good thing, because apparently the singer was drunk or high or both and slurred the words in the Garden of Eden. What you're hearing, in fact, wasn't supposed to be recorded. This was a sound check. The producer hadn't arrived, and the band was just kind of vamping in the studio, but the engineer was rolling tape. And at the end of it, decided, hey, this is actually pretty good, whatever In a Gata Da Vida is.
Creating an infinity of arguments between people at parties going, no, it's In a Garden of Eden, man, for sure, I know it, I know that. So, you know, that's the way it is, that's for sure. All right, some other examples.
Another example, and a kind of a similar one, is perhaps the most famous piece by Booker T and the MGs, the instrumental vamp known as Green Onions. I mean, this was, again, a case where the band is in the studio, and in fact, here they're waiting for a singer. A rockabilly singer was supposed to come in and do a jingle. They're in the Stax Records studio in Memphis. Singer's late. So the band's just kind of riffing on stuff in the studio, and Booker T has been playing this piano piece, tries it out on the organ, and the engineer once again is rolling tape. Now, this is 1962. Tape is expensive, but the engineer is also the owner of the studio. And the result is a classic. And the postscript is, it was released as a B-side.
Oh, fantastic. Now, this next story, I think, seems very, very plausible here.
Yes, Burning Down the House by Talking Heads. David Byrne had this habit of, you know, creating a song and having what he called a mumble track, where he would just kind of mumble syllables, words, whatever kind of fit the line of the melody. It wasn't necessarily to make sense.
Which explains a lot of the Talking Heads lyrics.
Maybe. Right.
They're sort of fit in there to support the music.
In this case, in the case of Burning Down the House, the mumble track worked so well with lines like, 365 degrees burning down the house that they just kept it.
That has total meaning to me. There's also a kind of a mumble track in one of the bridges where it goes.
there's a lot of wooing and hawing in some of those early David Byrne songs. I asked him once if he could write that way now, and he said, oh no. It's a completely different kind of technique of songwriting.
Now, do you think Burning Down the House was the original intent of the song? Something about Burning Down the House, or is even that, it's like a mumble title?
I think he probably had the title and then was just kind of, you know, lyrically vamping in the studio, and then it stuck.
Now, this kind of thing would never happen with the Beatles, right?
Well, you know, the Beatles were always so careful about what they were doing and so considered in what they did. The Lennon-McCartney thing we now know was often either Lennon or McCartney, but A Day in the Life was a case of Lennon and McCartney each having half of a song and not knowing how to finish it, and then kind of stitching it together in the studio. The stitching, the stuff that weaves together, John's tale ripped from the headlines, and Paul's tale of nostalgia for his commute to school, is the orchestra. But that's not what it originally was. They didn't know how they were going to weave these things together. So in the studio, they had their assistant counting out the bars. And then an alarm clock, which signaled, all right, now we go to Paul's song.
Woke up, fell out of bed, dragged a comb across my head.
All that was supposed to come out, but the alarm clock stayed in. They couldn't edit it out. And of course, it's the perfect lead-in to Paul's line, woke up, got out of bed.
Fantastic. Give me one more.
I'll give you one more. The song that brought rap music to the world, Rapper's Delight.
I said a hit. The hip to the hip, hip hop, you don't stop the rocker to the bang bang boogie. Say up, jump the boogie to the rhythm of the boogie to beat.
By the Sugar Hill Gang.
Right.
There was no Sugar Hill Gang. This was producer Sylvia Robinson, who had had a previous hit with Pillow Talk, a kind of schlocky early 70s light rock number. But she had heard about this hip hop thing, and she had these musicians who were playing the riff to Good Times, and she wanted people to do this rap thing over it. And she couldn't convince any rappers to come into the studio because they were all it was a live art form. It was done in the clubs.
Mm.
Her son finds a guy in the local pizza parlor and drags him into the studio. That guy turns out to be the late Big Bank Hank, who actually had to borrow lyrics from another early hip-hop artist, Grandmaster Caz, and that's what you hear in Rapper's Delight.
It's a great story.
The song was done in one take, 14 minutes long, then they edited down the radio version.
And next time when you come back, we'll have examples of shows you did after you were wandering around.
They were all done that way.
John Schaefer, host of Soundcheck and New Sounds at our partner station, WNYC. Thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
That's The Takeaways, John Hockenberry.
Even if you didn't spend your formative years in Arizona, you've probably heard someone mention Wallace and Ladmo. It was a kids' TV show, but it was more than that. There was subversive humor and characters that included a senior citizen whose bedtime stories took unsettling turns and a superhero who was anything but. Wallace and Ladmo went off the air in 1989, but it's alive again on stage beginning tomorrow night in Scottsdale. Ben Tyler is the writer and director of the production, which focuses on the unexpected national popularity of the not-so-real rock band Hubcap and the Wheels, fronted by cast member Pat McMahon.
So Hubcap and the Wheels was Wallace's idea. You know, he looked around. They were always very contemporary. He looked around at all the, you know, super groups coming out of Britain and the surfer bands in California. And so he decided to create an overnight sensation, and they just declared Hubcap a hit, and the rest of the state went along with it. Everybody knew that Hubcap was really Pat, but that was the joke.
Well, my folks tell me don't get a job, or I'll turn into a worthless lot.
This caught fire to the point that this actually could have led to Pat becoming actually Hubcap and actually having his own album and hitting in Hollywood and whatnot.
It is something that doesn't sound plausible, but that's what makes it a good story. And it is a true story. They released Work, Work, a Dirty Word, and for 1 week in Phoenix, for the local record sales in the greater Phoenix metropolitan area, it outsold every artist on the charts, including the Beatles.
But you ought to see me drag in a second year.
And Capitol Records got wind of this, and they sent out a representative to find out who is Hubcap and the Wheels and why are they selling so many records. He showed up at a concert at West High School, saw everybody going crazy, didn't realize that everybody in the gymnasium was in on this joke, and went backstage, and from what Pat tells me, and I can only believe him, of course, is that the guy pulled a contract out of his jacket and said, I couldn't understand a word you said out there, but I want you to sign this contract. And they signed the contract. They went out to Los Angeles. And while they were there, they were instructed that Pat was to remain Hubcap the entire time. He could not be Pat McMahon. He had to have the wig and the eyebrows and the whole ridiculous getup on. And the Wheels, which was the rest of the band, were not allowed to utter a word to anybody. They had to remain stoic, silent, and never say anything. And, you know, even though you're in Los Angeles on the top of the heap like that, that got old pretty quick.
Was that causing a divide there? Was this a real happy family? And then this thing with Hubcap and the Wheels made it less happy?
It was always a happy family. I mean, and I'm not just saying that to gloss things over. I mean, when I came in to work on the show, they had been on the air already for about 30 years. And the thing that struck me immediately was how much they enjoyed doing it. There was no burnout. You would think after 30 years of doing the same show that there would be some burnout. Every show was a party. Everybody was excited. Everybody had just a great time. I've never enjoyed a job so much in my life. But if they would have had to go forward and do the Wallace and Labneau show without Pat, I don't know how they would have done it. I mean, it would have been very difficult because they weren't just losing one person. They were losing this whole array of characters that Wallace had created. And I don't think the audience would have accepted somebody else stepping in. And now suddenly it's a different Gerald and a different Captain Super and a different Aunt Maud. It would have been too much. It was a real crossroads.
And that crossroads in Phoenix entertainment history is at the core of the Wallace and Labneau show play, which opens tonight at Scottsdale Stagebrush Theater. We talked to Ben Tyler, the writer and director. The show is produced by our senior producers, Sarah Ventry and Jimmy Jenkins, with help from Bruce Drummond, Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez, Tiara Vian, and Anika Klein. Tracy Greer, Sky Shout, Maria Springs are our digital team. The news director is Al Macias. Our executive producer is John the Thoroughbred Hoban.
We always want to hear from you. Let us know what you think. Let us know some good story ideas. Tell us if you won any money from the Belmont, the show at kjzz.org. I'm Mark Brody. For Steve Goldstein, this is member-supported KJZZ-FM Phoenix and HD. All Things Considered is next. It's 3 o'clock.